Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Annika Speer. I'm a professor in the Department of Theater, Film, and Digital Production, and I'm the co-director of the Public Speaking Initiative.
at
Oh, at UCR, at
University of
University of
California.
California, Riverside. Thank you.
I should have said, Prof, about 40% of listeners are in the US, but the rest
Okay.
are really all over the world. So
Yeah.
I may hop in and be boring about an acronym or a context or whatever.
Good context. Thank you.
I mean, I find mansplaining to be a source of endless pleasure, really, don't you?
I love being on the receiving end of it.
Anyway, moving right along. Prof, I wondered if I could ask you to share with us what's currently intoxicating, troubling, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you.
This is such a large question, and there's a number of threads. I sort of hate myself for saying this, but at the moment, AI. And AI, so because I teach public speaking and I teach embodied performance and storytelling, for a living, and I work with students across disciplines, I had in some ways thought that our field would be safe from this. It's embodied performance. You can't, robot out your embodiedness, and yet the sheer quantity of which the rapidity at which I'm seeing students kind of outsource their own voices in favor of a robot is something that I'm newly stressed by, alarmed by, saddened by, that I want to work with students to prioritize their own voices. So that's been something that's been showing up in the classroom, in some of my consulting work with different people, just the immediate presence of AI for speech writing.
Wow, that's amazing. I used to be a speech writer and I had to use a pen and paper.
Right.
I didn't even have what was in that. Do you ever heard of a thing called a word processor, folks? There was one word processor per three floors in the big building where I worked.
Oh my gosh.
But I hear what you're saying. And it's presenting real challenges to people on both sides, the side of people who are making things, allegedly, and the side of people who are evaluating things, allegedly, right? So who makes the thing has become a really big issue for students, for critics, and for creators. I mean, scientists are arguing all the time about the role that artificial intelligence should play in authoring scientific papers, right? And of
Right.
course, in copyright terms, there's only a little bit of law yet in the US. USA, always number one on copyright. But so far, the lower courts don't seem very keen on saying that AI can have copyright.
Yeah, I think it's a source. I'm trying not to be an absolute technological Luddite, and I recognize when something is a tool. I use calculators and all of that too. So I'm trying to be open-minded and open-hearted to the potential of this as a tool and a resource. But I'm also very unnerved, I think, by and unclear because it's not my area of expertise, but the lack of regulation and the way it's being used and how we're supposed to evaluate it and where and how we want to use it. I mean, there was just a massive, obviously, writer's strike in my discipline in theater and film, so that people couldn't be replaced as writers by this. But how do we use it mindfully and creatively and train our students to use it mindfully and creatively and not lazily, sloppily, as a source of misinformation to replace our own creative and critical thought? That's, I think, what's been on my mind. It's taken up a lot of space lately.
So this is a question not meant as a challenge, but out of my own ignorance. 20 years ago, when I moved from New York to LA, and I'd be sitting in my coffee shop, local coffee shop, working, most of the people beavering away morning, noon, and night were writing scripts for Casper the Friendly Ghost or
Sure. Yeah.
some other imagined possibility. They were all using script writing, screenwriting software. And are you seeing a big jump from those days of everybody using a certain software to what the newest iterations are doing with your students or people you're consulting for?
Yes, because software, I would say, is formatting. Software is like EndNote, or it's form, it's you hit Control X and you copy and you paste or whatever. Software shortcuts you to the dialogue, the log line, the whatever. It doesn't craft the content. So what AI is doing is generating, just at a snap of the fingers, the content, right? And for better or worse, it can be used again as a great tool for brainstorming or for thinking through something, but to just shortcut to using that content is what I'm seeing both with students and with, we talk, not just students, colleagues, or you were talking about in the sciences, people writing scientific articles, people then writing reviews of those scientific articles, and so on, so on, so on.
So I
So it's
guess,
different from software, it's different from a formatting software or like a Grammarly, like an autocomplete, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
and yet there are sort of connections, I think, in the sense of the way in which one writes being determined not by so much by one's fingers, but via a set of norms that have been instantiated electronically and then get picked up. I mean, what about, say, if, I mean, you've been involved a lot as, I don't know, is the right term a script doctor for some of the things that you do, or if I got that wrong?
Yeah, there's different terms for it. People call it a creative exec, a script doctor. Probably the behind the scenes term most commonly used is like a dramaturg, like a writer, like a researcher, a writer researcher or a research assistant in a lot of projects.
So you're used to people drawing on structures that have been around for centuries, in ideas about musical interludes that have been around for at least a century, if not more, genres, remakes. My daughter and I just watched the 1998 remake of The Parent Trap. So the idea of something creatively springing from someone's mind becomes quite complex when you put all that stuff together, or no?
I think you're right. I mean, adaptation has always existed, right? We're constantly adapting from the things that are coming at us and the tools in our toolbox. And then, oh, I'm going to try to go into my theory brain here. Marvin Carlson, right, wrote about ghosting, which is the drawing on, the thing that came before. So the versions of Hamlet you saw before, from the productions to the actors to the sort of the hauntings from the past, are also informing our own original and creative thought. So it is it. Now it is like that. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Are we still talking about AI, or are we talking about the process of screenwriting, or both? Like the parallels or comparisons. Is that what you're getting at?
It could be. I don't think I'm sure. Let me just see what ChatGPT tells me I'm supposed to say next.
Yeah, I can respond using the same. No, I know. I sort of feel in some way when you ask what's worrying me, I picked this thing, but it's also the thing that I understand the least. So in some ways, maybe it's the silliest thing to try to talk about on a podcast, because what's sort of needling at me is trying to make sense of, well, is it so different from these other tools? Well, is it informing our process? Is it inherently damaging? Like, I don't want to come from a place where I'm always already, negatively connotated towards this thing. When your point about adaptation or other forms of drawing on the old or drawing on something
I mean, I
else.
think there's a point that you were making about palimpsests or
Yes.
intertextuality and how much of that there is, the tissue of quotations that makes us. At the same time, I'm not wishing in any sense to counter your concerns. I'm just wondering whether they're part of a, they have a family of resemblance with these other norms that a lot of us have to engage in. You know, when Bruno Latour writes about a scientific article and how it's generated, he writes about, yes, of course, there's the element of nature or experimentation that is being described, but then there are norms about the structure of the article. There are norms about satisfying the funders that want certain work done. And so there are these textual elements and these social forces that are just as determinant of what the scientific proof says as what was allegedly found out. Do you know what I mean? And it's that sort of mixture and that family resemblance element that puzzles me, and I'm just thinking aloud, really.
Same. I mean, I'm thinking aloud with you. Same. Yeah, the palimpsest is a really good example. I guess I'm thinking of that in context with our work as educators. And what does it mean or look like if you don't learn or have the historical knowledge base or the understanding of the layers in the palimpsest? If you're only, so that's the part where it's like the tool versus the relying on it. I don't have children, but friends with children have told me, I don't know how old your daughter is, but maybe, you know, there's a reason in elementary school or they're not allowed to use the calculator until they first learn what 2 + 2 is, because you want them to have the knowledge base and the thinking to draw from to then understand the layering on of the tool. And I think that's where I'm trying to figure out,
Yes,
we
that's an
didn't
interesting
afford a
point.
word processor. I didn't even get a laptop till after I graduated undergrad, right? So it's like we have years of working without it that now inform the way that we work with it. But what about a 15-year-old in high school or an 18-year-old coming to college? How are we marrying that critical and that creative thinking without immediately outsourcing to the tool? I think that's what I'm trying to
Sure.
worry my way through as an educator.
Now, moving on to, in inverted commas, live performance, not film, not television, not essay writing, but some of the important work that you teach, public speaking and also embodied performance was, I think, one of the terms you used. I've only just learned about the Public Speaking Initiative in the University of California, and you're at the head of it. Could you tell us a bit about that, but not just a plug for it, though that's fine too, but actually, you know, what is public speech? Why do people need to learn it? What does it entail?
Yeah, happy to plug it and then talk it out. Yeah. So it was spearheaded by distinguished professor Jody Enders, who's a rhetorician at University of California, Santa Barbara. And she named me as the co-director. She started it in 2017 and named me as the co-director in 2019. And we are both invested in, you know, there's back in the day, I think it was reading, writing, and rhetoric was a huge part of an education. And then in the age of infoglut, as we've gotten students and all of us have gotten more and more comfortable kind of behind the screens, rhetoric also at some point fell out from being treated as a requirement. And yet we know that communication and speaking, the reason you have a podcast and you have podcast listeners is that we make meaning and we learn and we know it's pedagogical, it's epistemological, it's a way of connecting and moving through the world. You know, there's all this emphasis across universities on writing in the disciplines, and yet there is far less actual emphasis on speaking in the disciplines, or certainly there's less training on speaking in the disciplines. So a key mission of the Public Speaking Initiative is to kind of bring back a collective understanding of the value of rhetorical studies and speech and communication in and across disciplines. And then, of course, the challenge is it is both a tool that I want my students to have in their toolbox. It's a skill, but also kind of deconditioning administrators and others from us from just talking about it in that way, because it's a way of, it's not a one and done. I talk about it like it's not like you go and you get a driver's license and there you have the, you know, you've sort of checked this thing off the list. It's a way that we're moving through the world and talking and communicating and making meaning and learning all the time. So it's a practice. It's part of what we do as educators. I think it's a form of research, frankly, right? That when we give talk, you don't just write the article and read each other's articles. We go to conferences and we give talks for reasons. So it's kind of really bringing back a valuing of that. And then just for audiences elsewhere, UC Riverside is unique in that. So I actually have a PhD in theater and a postdoc in communication. And normally public speaking would be housed, I think probably at the majority of universities, it's housed under the Department of Communication. But because at our university, we don't actually have a Department of Communication, for better or worse, for me, for better, what's exciting is public speaking is housed in the Department of Theater and it's treated as part of embodied performance. So public speaking, most of the public speaking books are kind of written from a social science perspective. If you pick up almost any public speaking book, a lot of it focuses on the writing and the craft of like research, writing, construction, organization, and far less emphasis on the delivery performance part of it. And yet that's the thing. If you ask anybody what their fear of public speaking is, of course, it's an anxiety around delivery. So that's a maybe a long-winded way of saying that the goal of this initiative is to really think about embedding public speaking, and I don't just want to say training, but practices into our disciplines and in valuing it as an interdisciplinary way of interacting as well.
I think that's wonderful. And of course, it's also important for job interviews and for
Yeah.
sitting on committees and making arguments in departments. There are all kinds of contexts where having the proverbial silver tongue can be of great assistance.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to cut to the job interview, but it's true, and that's an obvious one, and that's one we do an entire unit on that in my advanced public speaking class with students. We do an entire prep, of impromptu speech where you know you're going to be talking, but you don't know what you're going to be asked, so preparing to speak off of the cuff. But it's so important interpersonally. My greatest joy of teaching this class is students will email me. We all get this as professors, right? But they'll email you a couple years later, even, and they'll tell you how the thing that you taught is now suddenly part of their lives. And students will tell me everything from that they now work as a social worker and they're talking to X number of people every day, or to that they've gotten much better at arguing with their partner or their parents, or they'll give me interpersonal examples of how like they really think through persuasive speech and other oriented arguments, and it has just changed the way they communicate. So it's my favorite thing to teach and think about because it's the thing that I know people are using across every aspect of their life.
I
Not that
mean,
I don't talk about Shakespeare or other stuff, but
it has some of its origins in the United States in the reform era, of course, and the need, and this is why it really took off down the spine of the Midwest and into the South, more than in the Northeast or on the West Coast, because it was about allowing recent white migrants or whitish migrants from Eastern and Western Europe and some from Central Europe to be able to form a proletariat effectively or be effective farm laborers when English wasn't their first language. And so speech communication, rhetoric, forensics, all these other names have a really important history in allowing English to become a lingua franca, but also giving working class migrants, albeit largely excluding descendants of slaves and Latinos and so on, a way of finding, of being able to communicate and learning how to present an argument in a particular form, you know, and
Yeah, oh,
became
that's
a
perfect.
trade union movement and so on, right?
Yeah, what it means for activism, I think, we talk about the interview. We can talk about it in terms of sort of like neoliberal, like kind of, capitalist umbrellas, but also what it means exactly for collective organizing or activism, or pushing back, or, I think that's where else and how else can we teach our students those values, and rhetoric is a massive part of that. And then relatedly is the confidence building. So the empower, I think not that you can empower somebody, students empower themselves, but when what some of what we try to do as educators is help them find and hone their creative voice, sharpen their ability to communicate the things that they value and hold dear. I read an article a little while ago. This was after the shooting at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas, the high school shooting. And those kids at that university, at that high school, kind of many of them became outspoken activists, and a number of them were theater majors. And it wasn't lost on me that they were coming out of their rehearsals of Spring Awakening. They were coming out of their theater training and then kind of taking the national stage and leading, you know, not one more sort of marches, using what they were learning as embodied performing theater students and then bringing it into the public sphere in these ways that were meaningful and important to them.
And of course, the expression finding your voice is very important in theatre, but it's been important for the women's movement or movements, for minority social movements, and so on, right? As you talk about gaining confidence, voices unlike mine that are traditionally, historically suppressed and the same today are given this opportunity and this training, yeah?
Yeah, it's part of consciousness raising, I think.
And one of the things that you've done in your work is, I think, a remarkable blend of the humanities and the social sciences. So you're almost a social science nerd with your collaborative authorship of experimental work. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, and so this is what I mean, I guess, before when I was saying there's all these threads to what we do, right? In some ways, I would feel immense imposter syndrome claiming any kind of social science training. You know, I'm not trained in anything quantitative. So I'm on these collaborative projects where I'm sort of the arts humanities person, and then I'm collaborating with people in the STEM fields or the social science fields. A big example, I would say, is maybe the work that I do with the Science to Policy program, which is a program at UC Riverside, started by Susan Hackwood, who was the chair of the board, the dean of the Department of Engineering for a long time and is now emeritus. But this is the program that seeks to train scientists to not who don't plan on going into the ivory tower, who plan on going out into the world and working in policy making and getting our scientists to communicate complicated technical information to outside audiences. So if you think about from climate change to COVID education or vaccines, right? We're so often trained to talk either within our disciplines or within the institution and not beyond the walls of the institution. So we have a $3 million NSF grant right now for a project called Speaks, where we are working on embedding communication practices into the sciences. So public speaking is my part of it, although other people are training them on, you know, writing op-eds, writing white papers, delivering information, again, yeah, beyond the walls of our discipline. So that's, I think, one. I don't know if I call myself a social scientist because I still think of myself as the arts person on the project, but that's an example of, I think, the interdisciplinary pr potential of this kind of work. And then to bring it back to my own discipline, I would say there's a marrying or a dovetailing of my interest in communication dovetails with my interest in theater and political theater and contemporary theater and activist and social justice theater. So I have work on projects like Jane is a play about the reproductive justice movement, pre-Roe v. Wade, abortion in the underground, where the Jane Collective, it was a group of women before 1973 when Roe v. Wade happened and abortion was at the time legalized at the federal level, since changed in our moment, right? But this group of women, housewives, grad students, they started off as a referral network, and then they discovered that the doctors or the people they were sending women to were, in some cases, not doctors, were causing harm, were sexually harassing or assaulting women, were charging exorbitant fees. And long story short, this collective taught themselves how to perform abortions, and they performed over 11,000 abortions with no fatalities, before Roe v. Wade happened. But because what they were doing was radical, was illegal, was off the grid, right? It wasn't, they weren't creating documentation of it. So a journalist, Paula Kamen, did interviews with them. You know, these women were doing work in the 60s and 70s. They were interviewed in the 90s, and then this play was written about them in the early aughts. And that's a play that I've directed at UC Santa Barbara with Middlebury students. And it's kind of thinking through how does this play that is, it's drawing from the real, the historical real from interviews, but it's also weaving in fiction. What makes it a docudrama instead of documentary is that it's fact meeting fiction because it's imagining the pieces that are missing. So it relates to what you were saying about, consciousness raising or women's voices, LGBTQ voices, people whose voices are left off the public record. Well, then how do we make documentary about that historical past? We include theatrical fiction. So it marries my interest in sort of communication, be that trial transcripts, documented communication with narrative fiction and the power of storytelling and theater. So that's an ex not a social science example, but an example of like the public speaking and the communication weaving in with other facets of my work.
So, can I ask about realism in all of this?
Yes. Oh gosh, I feel like I'm taking a PhD exam. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I don't
No.
mean, this is not meant to indicate I know the answer, does she?
No. Yeah.
But I know it can sound that way. I'm thinking back to some of the debates that occurred in the 70s in Britain about Brechtian performance and Middlemarch, the George Eliot novel, often heralded as a peak moment of realism and socialist realism. The idea being that, the carefully noted historical novel may miss out on underpinning social relations. The agitprop, in your face shock of a Brecht may not appear naturalistic to people and may not appear realistic, but may get at underpinning social realities that are hidden in conventional realism. It's that sort of issue that I'm wondering about.
Yeah, I'm just going to spin out loud with you on this because I don't know how to answer that exactly. But yes, so Brecht and Verfremdung effect, alienation effect, right? This idea that that the problem with a problem, I'm putting this in scare quotes in case it's listened to as a podcast, a problem with realism, right, is that the audience so recognizes or see themselves in the character, the production, or whatever, that they're not distanced enough to want to take political action or they're not motivated to change. That's the alienation effect that Brecht is kind of famous for. So that's benefit number one of arguing against or moving away from realism or not only holding up like realism as king in terms of a theatrical storytelling way. And then to tie this kind of relatedly to back to documentary. So there's a scholar who I really like, but whose work I took issue with when I was doing the research. So part of what I discovered when I was researching docudrama as a graduate student, and when I got interested, I originally thought I was looking at documentary. And then suddenly I'm looking at plays that are dealing with voices that haven't been captured or given the right space in the public sphere. So now I'm looking at docudrama and I discovered that it was treated really pejoratively. People talk about it like it's this picture, sort of the seedy reenactment, a boat based on a true story, kind of those Lifetime movie type of. It was getting that kind of treatment. This like, oh, it can't draw from the real, and so it's this inferior substitute. So Eric Bentley, who was a scholar at Columbia, he famously wrote a beautiful play called Are You Now or Have You Ever Been about the communists, the Red Scare in the US, the communist trials. And he has this argument, more or less goes like this, but take only the words that people said in the public sphere. No investigative reporting, no interviews, only what was said in the public. And that's what you can use. Otherwise, you're being sort of dishonest. Otherwise, the audience doesn't know that it's being lied to. But so his play beautifully takes all the words from the trial transcripts of the communist trials, right? The McCarthy trials. However, to tie back to what you were saying, that misses to me the point that what people said in the public sphere was they were confined by the discursive circumstances that shaped those utterances, right? So you have somebody on trial for their life who's about to be blacklisted, who's having their career, their selves defamed, their families, trashed, their livelihoods lost. we're supposed to take the words on the public sphere that existed in this discursive constructed circumstances as truth with a capital T. That's more true than something off the record, than an imaginative fiction that gets to the circumstances. So that kind of underpinned my interest in, oh, docu. I'm not saying docudrama is a substitute for documentary, but docudrama does something that documentary doesn't. And fiction does something that that journalism doesn't do, right? And both of these can hold up a mirror to ourselves, ask us to imagine the lived realities of people, ask us to imagine potential differences. I think I've maybe wandered off the answer a little, but does that tie to what you're talking about? I think in terms of realism, like the problem with both my interest in the real, and then also, of course, we know the problem with the real.
No, I think you've put it beautifully. I wonder if I could change tack a little, Prof, now and
Sure.
ask you another very big question. If one goes back almost a century to the beginnings of sound film, this is a moment when screenwriters in Hollywood, who had probably mostly been women, suddenly, with the advent of recorded dialogue, are edged out by novelists and playwrights from New York who were blokes. Guys flood into Hollywood, and not just famous writers, but hacks, right?
Sure.
And Broadway becomes, along with novels, a very common source for Hollywood and a stimulus to Broadway, even during the Depression. And in some ways, that continued at least through the 50s. I'm wondering how theatre is doing now in the United States, not necessarily at the hyper-commercial level, though that might be how you answer it. And when I say hyper-commercial, that sounds rather critical. I don't feel that way. That's not what I'm saying. But also at the experimental end.
This is a big question, and I'll do my best to answer. I don't want to overstep my area of expertise. So, better and not better is the short answer. And the longer answer is, right around the 2020 and George Floyd, there was a big movement culturally and politically in general across the US for so many reasons. But one of them was a calling out of white American theater so this is more the commercial level, right? Same problems we have in academia that we have in theater. This institution that sees itself as kind of a bastion of progressive ideals is, of course, reifying the racism, the sexism, the transphobia. It's reifying all of the systemic issues that we know exist elsewhere. And then Hollywood and theater are no exception to that. So certainly on a commercial level, if this is something people are further interested in, the Center for Women in TV and Film, which is based out of University of California, San Diego, does a beautiful job tracking this. So they keep records of the 200 highest grossing films, TV shows, et cetera, every year. And they literally crunch the numbers for you. They give you the data on women of color, women in speaking roles, percentages of people in writing positions behind the screens, in front of the screen, et cetera. And the answer is it's better than it used to be, but it's still really bleak. I mean, in some cases, it's something like 7% of Latina women have speaking parts, or 2% of editors are women. So commercially, it's pretty terrible still. Experimentally, and I don't know what I don't know, but I think that's where a lot of more radical movement is happening, that there is a DIY spirit. And on the one hand, theater and commercial theater can be rather expensive. But on the other hand, in the age of the iPhone, or you can put together a play with a bucket on a street corner if you want to. There's all kinds of ways to be radical and experimental and I think that especially if you're not just an actor waiting to get cast, if you get trained or work towards writing and making your own work, then there's so much more potential. But I'm not a historian, and this is not fully my area of expertise, so I don't want to misstep, but that would just be my overview, I would say.
I feel for you because you're being set up in this conversation as knowing about a vast array of things, as I keep asking you bigger and bigger questions, or more silly, or sillier and sillier ones, perhaps. But I wanted to ask you about something that you've done quite a bit of work on, if I may, and
Sure.
that you mentioned earlier. There were all kinds of portfolio words that were being deployed, but I think the one that satisfied you was dramaturgy. Can you tell
Yeah.
us about your work in that?
Yeah. So your dramaturgy is sort of what I would say is a fancy word for researcher or consultant. It can mean different things to different people, but if you're a dramaturg on it's works in process, a project that is in development. You are assisting the writer or the director. You're bringing the vision to life and you're asking questions, whether they be about, world building or historical accuracy or whatever the case might be, depending on the project. So I kind of lucked into this, fell into this. So much of our careers, one of the things I tell our students about, I hate the word networking, but it's so true. Like, our network doesn't have to be this schmoozy cocktail party kind of thing. It's literally meeting people and connecting with them and then potentially collaborating with them. And so when I was a graduate student at University of California, Santa Barbara, I took at the time Professor Erin Cressida Wilson, who's a screenwriter. She's most famous for the movie Secretary with James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal. That's the movie that made her famous, but she's done other works. I took her class and we hit it off, and she asked if I wanted to come be a researcher for her. So I started as a just kind of a graduate student assistant researcher, and then she left the university and just continued her professional screenwriting career. And I continued. She said, "Will you keep working? I love collaborating with you. I love working with you. Will you keep working with me?" And of course, it was a joy to be on these projects. So I just continued on. Mainly, my partnership was in that relationship and with her on her film projects because she specializes in, I would say, contemporary adaptation, most of her projects. So Secretary was first a short story by Mary Gateskill. She did the movie Men, Women, and Children with Jason Reitman. It's based on Chad Colchin's book. She did a remake of Chloe based on I think it was a French horror film called Natalie with Julianne Moore and I want to say Amanda Seyfried. So her work tends to specialize in female-driven adaptation of books. So a lot of my research for her was based on adapting text to script. So sometimes that was thinking about, research on location. Sometimes that was starting with the book text and pulling all of the dialogue and thinking through what we could gain just from the dialogue and what we lose from the novel and working with her needs individually. So that's my behind the scenes on dramaturging.
Fantastic. Thank you. Prof, I have two more questions for you, if you may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish. It might be that you want to add something to what we've already mentioned or another topic again. Sound okay as a way of
Yes, of
concluding?
course. Yes, thank you.
So, first question, I read your article on the S word.
Oh,
Tell us about the S word. It sounded absolutely fascinating.
Oh, of all things to read, that's an interesting one. So that makes sense to me with you connecting me to social sciences as well. So my colleague, distinguished professor Bella Merlin, who's a brilliant actor, director, educator, writer. She's an expert in Shakespeare and Stanislavski, and she put together an international symposium here in Riverside called the S Lab or the S Word. And she brought together people across disciplines to play with Stanislavski techniques and Shakespeare. And we were broken into different groups, and we did kind of a weekend long intensive workshop process, acting exercise. But in that, through that, I met a colleague, now very close collaborator and friend, Dr. Kalina Michalska, who is a neuroscience professor in psychology. And she specializes in a number of things. So forgive me, Kalina, if I mess this up, but in working with children in empathy, in neuro, in brain imaging, in eye contact research, in anxiety among children. And so Dr. Michalska and I were having, out of this interaction, we were having really exciting conversations about the relationship between theater and neuroscience and the relationship between sort of acting and audience interaction, like what it means for an actor to be making eye contact with the audience and kind of that energy exchange and tying it to, you know, what she scientifically knows about how the brain works. So we dipped our toe into a collaboration there. And from there, we've developed further collaboration. We just wrapped up work on a $50,000 NIH grant for the Center for Health Disparities Research. And we've been doing research using my public speaking students and her psychology expertise to kind of better understand what role embodied performance might offer to alleviate, you know, so many of our students suffer from anxiety and depression and sort of, especially post-COVID, you know, a number of mental health stuff. Not all of them want Western-oriented treatment. Not all of them want psychological services, but how might public speaking training and embodied performance alleviate some of what they're dealing with and benefit them in a non kind of medical way while still having these psychological benefits. So we did about three quarters worth of data collection with my students and are analyzing the data now and kind of seeing what they said about embodied performance impacting potentially their well-being. And part of the excitement there was so much to tie it back to public speaking. So much of the research on public speaking, as you could probably guess, is about the anxiety. The PSA, public speaking anxiety, dominates the field that, but there's actually less research on confidence and empowerment and well-being. It's not nearly as delved into. So that's kind of a collaboration that came out of the S lab into this other sort of related space.
And just to clarify a couple of acronyms you've mentioned, just
Oh,
now
sorry.
you said NIH, National Institutes of Health. Earlier you mentioned NSF, National Science Foundation. These are not places that people associated with creative writing, the humanities, history, theater, etc., are generally found. And it's an amazing thing that you've achieved by collaborating with these folks, which I sense you're playing down in a modest way, and I'm sure that your collaborators feel as though you contribute a great deal. However, that's not for me to know. It's for you to know.
Well, I very much appreciate tell that to my tenure review. Just kidding. I very much appreciate that. Yeah, I think there's sometimes, I don't know if other academics feel this way. Sometimes I have those moments of feeling like I'm a little bit of a weird bird because it's hard to define just in one category, like, oh, I'm a theater scholar who does theater in this way, right? I think the more I've been doing communication work in theater, the more kind of interdisciplinary it has gotten. So, you know, my publication record maybe looks a little. Some of these publications are in engineering journals, and then some of them are in theater or feminist studies journals or a musical theater journal, or, you know, it kind of runs the gamut because the work, I think, is so interdisciplinary. But it's, yeah, in some ways it's confusing, and in other ways it's a massive gift and a huge opportunity, I think, to collaborate.
I always think, for what it's worth, that if you can weave a story that can make sense to people about your life, then those hurdles, those obstacles, those strange pathways can become quite logical. But
Yeah.
a bit like in an interview for a job where you need to go in and think about what are the points of resistance against you? What are the reasons why these people don't want to give you a job? And how, especially in the United States, where people are so artificially polite, but in fact quite vicious when you're not there, the crucial thing is to think, these people want me to like them, which means they're going to lie about what they think. So I need to bring into the interview all the
Yeah.
bad things about me that they might be thinking and answer them. And then their post-hoc viciousness can't take full effect. So
Yeah.
the big thing is to have a story.
Yeah. Well, story, I mean, story is everything. We think in story, we dream in story, you tell your partner or your daughter about your day in story. It's really how we make meaning. So our careers are no different, right? It's connecting the dots for your listener through like, this is the thing that led to that, and this is the reason that XYZ is taking place. But it's an exercise in connecting the dots when they may seem disparate or nonsensical.
So my last question after my childish provocation about mendacity in US academia,
Love it.
and US academia was very, very good to me, and I owe an enormous amount to the people at the places where I worked. Because I did work out that they will lie about everything to your face, so you've got to get around their desire to be liked. My last question, Prof, is to ask, you've already told us a little bit about what's on the docket, but I want to know what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I'm 65. Do you know what you want to be when you grow up?
It's so actually refreshing to hear someone who's 65 say that because I'm 42. And yes and no. I think it's nice when people who are so established and accomplished in my eyes are having some of the same identity, like the sky's the limit, what am I doing now sort of thing. I think a gift. So I did have a moment. This is not to say I know what I want to be growing up. I know how I want to work different than how I've been working. So I think COVID happened. I turned 40. I got tenure. So there were three sort of big things that happened in a short kind of time span where I had a reflective moment of not that the last 10 years weren't great and not that I'm not very grateful for my career, but I don't want the next 10 years to look like the last 10 years in terms of my relationship with work, my obsessive, I mean, I guess I kicked it off with AI and my obsessive rumination, right? Like so some of this is maybe I say it out loud and I manifest it better, but a little bit of behavioral change, getting out of my own way so I can do the parts of our job that are a joy, which is the teaching our students and interacting with, the future is a joy. Listening to your daughter's voice on a pod, listening to young people tell stories and find their voices and hone their craft is such a joy. So the public speaking and the consulting and the teaching are part of what they've been what it's looks like, but they're part of what I care about keeping. But then in terms of creative work, I think I've long been a collaborator on a lot of other people's projects, and I'm working more towards money where the mouth is, valuing my own projects. So writing I have drafts of my own novel in progress. I have drafts of my own public speaking book in progress. I have a collaborative, but that I'm doing a lot of heavy lifting on a script project in progress. And now that I've gotten the stability and the safety that I was looking for a long time, I was an adjunct and a lecturer before I was a professor, right? I was fighting for kind of, getting stability. Now that I have those things, leaning into the opportunity to do the thing that feeds the soul, which is read and write and think and make art. So it is my hope that that's what the next 10 year, tw 20, 30, 50, what I am when I grow up.
I want some of that. And
Yeah.
finally, are there things you'd like to add to what we've discussed?
Oh my gosh. My instinct is to turn around and ask you a bunch of questions about your work, but you've told me not to do that in this pod. We'll do that another time. No, I think if I were to summarize, I think we covered a lot of ground, right? From public speaking to theater to communication to interdisciplinary work to teaching to AI in our current moment. I don't know. I'll think, you know what? I'll realize I want to add something 5 hours from now. At 3 in the morning, I'll wake up and be like, and another thing.
And another thing. Well,
Yeah. But right now, no, I feel very happy. And this is the delight of what we do. When you imagine a life of the mind, it's the ability to talk to just so many different people about so many different ideas. So this has been a real pleasure.
thank you, Prof. A. I am fortunate enough to serve on a committee with you which is how we met. We've only ever met virtually, but that's how we met. And you're a brilliant voice on that committee, along with several other brilliant voices, I should say, mostly women on that committee who have interesting things to say, I've found anyway. And I feel as I've learned even more from you today, and your work is stunning. So thank you very
Oh,
much for being here.
a pleasure. Thank you for having me, inviting me, and valuing me. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you in the committee Zoom room probably fairly soon.